The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful, fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome in to episode 101 of the House of L podcast, and you're definitely going to get an education from our guest today. I'm Lawrence Holmes. I appreciate you checking out the podcast. I was telling you how there are some new innovations to the podcast. I'm working on it. Like, I'm trying to be as productive as I can with the time that is now available to me, as we all are in our home for more time than we would prefer to be. So I'm trying to relearn a skill, and that skill is editing video. I used to be able to do that, but that was all the way back in like the late 90s and early 2000s. Like, I understand editing, but trying to figure it out is definitely a challenge. But I am working towards, and I put it together this week. There is now going to be a YouTube page for the House of L podcast. So some of these conversations are going to find their way to the YouTube page because I've been doing them via Zoom. So there's video of me talking with my guests, including my guest for this week. So my hope is that you can go, by the time that you listen to it, that you can go to the YouTube page and that video will be up and you can check it out. And it's a really good conversation with a really good dude, my guy, Stephen Bardo. Stephen has done a little bit of everything from playing college ball, being a part of the Flying Illini, going to the NBA. He just posted a picture of him as a Detroit Piston on his Instagram page. I got a good chuckle out of that because I was talking about it on the air. I think that he's the best college basketball analyst in America. And yeah, I'm biased because that's my boy. It's one of my friends. But he's really tremendous at the way that he does his job. I think that he explains the game for those of us who didn't play the game. At that level, he brings us inside. He makes us understand what coaches are doing, what players are thinking about. Because he played point guard at a really severe level and had success doing it. But he's a motivational speaker. He's an author. He's out here trying to help young people, which I think is incredibly admirable, with his point guard vision program. He's just a good dude. And he's got an interesting story. For those of you who are Illini fans, I think that you're really going to enjoy this because he takes you inside the Illini program and takes you inside what it's like to be a member of the Flying Illini. But there's also a big conversation about education and the importance of it. It was very important to Stephen's parents. It's very important to him. And you'll understand why. I'm so happy that he said yes. He's one of the guests that I was trying to get for a really long time on this podcast. And I'm honored that he was like, yeah, let's do this thing. So we start off talking about a lot of stuff, as per usual. Episode 101 with Stephen Bardo. It opens with him giving me a shout out from a mutual friend of ours. Sit back, relax, and enjoy. Episode 101, Stephen Bardo.
Stephen Howard told me to tell you hello.
Oh, that's my guy, man. That
is. I just got off the phone with him. He told me to tell you hello.
That's my light skinned brother right there. He still got the good hair.
That's funny.
All right, ready to do this?
My guy. Yeah, let's do it.
All right, I have so much stuff so much ground I want to cover with you, but can I start with your dad? Can we talk about your dad for a second?
Sure.
He's a big deal in Carbondale. What was that like for you to grow up knowing that your dad was such a big deal?
Well, my brother and sister and I all walked in his footsteps. I mean, he's a giant of a man. He's done some extraordinary things. He's helped a ton of people. He loves helping students. And so, you know, we're just kind of, and I'm the baby of the family, so I just kind of walked into it, and this is how it was. And so, you know, it was good for me because everybody was looking out for us, if you know what I mean, Lawrence, because Carbondale, 30,000 people. Then when the students are there, it might get up to 55,000. So it's a small community. Everybody knows everybody. And so if people are looking out for you, they keep you out of trouble and, you know, support you when you do well.
How important was education in your household?
Number one, because mom and dad knew how to put the hooks in us. And, you know, they figured out, hey, if we can get them to love these sports, we can always take it away if they don't go to class or they, you know, slack off or they want to act up. It was always a hook. And they knew what they were doing because all they had to do was mention hey, you ain't going to practice or you may not be able to play. Whatever was wrong would get righted very quickly.
Do you remember when you kind of realized that you had a talent for ball?
God, that's a good question. I think, Lawrence, just because I was born into a basketball family that, again, I just kind of – my first memories are – either watching a game or having a ball in my hand. My brother didn't really want me tagging along behind him because I'm 6 years younger. So, you know, it was just, I born into a family of basketball. And that's my first childhood memories are either watching the game with my dad or trying to keep up with my brother going to the court.
But was there a point where you like, I'm good at this? Like, and it can be something instead of, you know, you're on the high school team. Like, for example, like I played high school freshman year and I knew that I was never going to do more than that. Like that was going to be the extent. Like I'm decent enough in a pickup game, but for you, like there's an opportunity for you. So when did that crystallize that you were going to, that it was more than just an activity that you were doing after school?
There was a tournament when I think I was in sixth grade and they moved me up to the seventh grade and it was a summer league tournament. And I balled out, Lawrence. I really did. And I don't remember why I was feeling so good or why I kind of was very aggressive when I hit the floor, but I was. And it was a 3-game tournament. We won the championship. I got MVP of the tournament as I got moved up. And that was kind of a sign. It was like, okay, if I really put my mind to this, I could be pretty good at this.
Okay. So once you get, now that you have that foundation, my guess knowing you is that was only like an appetizer. Like, like you getting that MVP was like, oh, and it, I'm guessing that it drove you once you had success.
Yeah, it's interesting, Lawrence, because, you know, my dad often said that he made me too humble. He and my mother made us too humble. And what he meant by that is, you know, sometimes we would defer on the court or sometimes we would, you know, me being a point guard, I'm looking to set other people up. And he's like, sometimes you need to set yourself up. And that's something that, you know, kind of wish I would have been a little bit more aggressive, but, you know, things turned out pretty good. But, you know, when you're coming from a background like that, every day is you just chip away. And it's not like they didn't let us put our heads up, Lawrence. It's you put your head down, you grind, you don't celebrate. You know, you talk amongst yourselves, you're happy, but you stay grounded, you keep working. And then maybe you look up, you're past your opponents. And that's that's kind of how the mentality was of my family.
Why did you gravitate towards point? Do you think it was something that was personality driven?
No, my dad put the ball in my hand. I didn't have a choice. Like, my brother was a two guard. He could really shoot. Lawrence, he's one of the best shooters I've ever seen. Seriously. And you know, I've seen a lot of shooters. 6'4", played at Indiana, played at the Citadel. He could really shoot it. But my dad was like, you know what? I'm going to put the ball in his hands. And he knew I was going to be tall. So it worked out.
Why Illinois?
Two things. The Nike All-American Camp, I can't remember the acronym, AFBE or something like that, AFBE, AFBE. Kendall wasn't there. It was Nick, Marcus, and I believe Kenny Battle was there as well. And all the Chicago guys and all the regional guys, they gravitate in those situations because you're looking for familiarity. It's a competitive environment, and you're young. And so I was hanging out with all of them, and they said, wouldn't it be cool if we all went to Illinois? And so we made a pact there. I didn't think it was going to last or whatever. I just went on about my business. And my last two choices were Illinois and Northwestern. And Lawrence, I was going to Northwestern. And then my dad told me to get in the car. And we took a little bit of ride. And he kind of explained to me, you'll be the best player on the worst team in the Big Ten. He said, you'll be miserable because you've never lost a day in your life and you're not going to win at Northwestern. I came out of the car, I got back home. I said, Mom, I'm going to Illinois. She was hot. She was upset, Lawrence. She didn't care about basketball, man. She wanted her baby to get a degree from Northwestern going to broadcasting. That was her old focus. So she was not happy, but it was the right decision.
So how do you smooth it over with her? Because she's clearly thinking beyond. Like, she's not thinking about the 4 years. She's thinking about 40. So how do you smooth it over with her that this is a good choice and you're going to end up in a great place?
I didn't have to smooth it over because she knew my dad told me where I was going. So if dad said it, it was like, all right, this is a done deal. So he did sleep on the couch for 2 weeks, though, Lawrence. No joke. After the first week, I come out, I'm like, Dad, what's up? He's like, I got this. I know what I'm doing. It was the right decision.
What did you take away from your experience? Forget basketball for a second. Your experience of being a student in Champaign, what was it like?
You know, I had a very rich experience as a student because I tried to do different things than the normal jocks or athletes were doing. I tried to get involved in different activities and things of that nature. So I had a very rich student experience at Illinois. You know, I would go to nursing homes with one of my assistant coaches sometimes, and the joy on the faces when they would see me, you know, would propel me through a week. You know, having difficult classes and having study groups and never really having study groups before, but the people look different and, you know, you kind of feeling each other out. And then after you get the project completed and you get a good grade and everybody's happy, it's the same as sports. So I had a really, really good and rich experience as a student at Illinois.
So how would you suggest that someone who is a scholarship athlete go about approaching their student life on campus? And I know that it's difficult with all the demands on time. Like, I've traveled with college basketball teams too. Like, those guys, it's amazing to me, like, what they're capable of doing. But how do you get the most out of that experience in 2020 and beyond?
Lawrence, I think you can do some things before, let's say, you're talking about student athletes, correct?
Mm-hmm.
So we have a scholarship basketball player. There's some things that a scholarship basketball player can do before they get to campus. One, take a Myers-Briggs test. Find out exactly what your strengths are, where you be, you know, where your personality is. Get as much information on that So then when you get to college, you can put yourself on the path of that immediately. You don't have to go and take 2 years and, you know, worry about prerequisites and things of that nature. If you think that you're going to play at the next level, right, you could come in and take marketing classes to boost up your YouTube and your social presence so that you can be attractive for local businesses to want to partner with you during your time so that you can make money and learn business while you're playing. So that can go for any student, not even a student athlete. That can go for any student. If the more information about what you're strong at and what you think you want to target, if you can get that going into college, then your student experience can really be enhanced.
I think that's really helpful because I always wonder about whether you're getting the full like mosaic of of the college experience, because the classes are one thing. I mean, I was a much better student at grad school over the last 2 years than I was in undergrad, you know, when I was a teenager. But the experiences that I had outside of the classroom, those are things that I'll take with me forever. And understanding how to navigate the world where you're on your own. I mean, granted, your parents are probably close by and the athletic department is going to take care of you to a certain extent, but you're making adult decisions for the first time in your life. Like that's a significant turning point in the arc of your life.
Oh, there's no question about it. And, you know, college can be overwhelming for some people. You know, you've seen it. I've seen it. People get down there, they lose their mind. They party too much. They can't handle the freedom and they flunk out or, you know, different things happen. So, you know, I was very fortunate in that I got the college experience in high school. Because remember, I told you, I grew up on SIU's campus and I was there all the time. So I kind of got a sense of how that thing was going to go. So I didn't have too much of a problem with that necessarily, but it is something where it's, you know, it's, you have to make grown folks decisions. You're still buffeted a bit. You know, you're almost like a bumper car. You got bumpers on the side. They won't throw you to the wolves immediately on the first mess up. But believe me, you continue, you'll be out of there.
What was the point where, as a collective, you guys knew that your team in 89 was a really special group?
We knew that freshman year when we came in because we were a 7-player group. We had Phil Kuntz and Jeff Finke. Jeff Finke went on to play football at Illinois. Phil Kuntz transferred to Iowa State. And then we had Kenny Battle that came in with us because he transferred from Northern Illinois. He came in with us that year. Kendall, Nick, Irvin, myself. Missing somebody. I'm missing one. I cannot believe it. I think I'm missing a walk-on or something. But we had a large freshman group. And there was Ken Norman, Tony Weisinger, and Doug Altenberger. These were all Big Ten performers. Ken Norman would end up being a lottery, first-round pick. And so we were working these cats in practice. Glenn Blackwell, Lowell Hamilton was the number one high school player in the country his senior year. And we'd go into practice, and they would get us eventually, but we'd work them. And we'd talk smack. Coach would break the teams up. You know, he put freshmen with upperclassmen. And we'd be like, no, because we're not starting. Let the starters go. We just go at them. So we knew freshman year that we had a special group.
What do you think created that mentality of you guys were kind of in attack mode from the moment that you walked onto campus?
My teammate Glenn Blackwell recently was sharing on my podcast that he said we were a focused group and he was tripping that I could bench 275 as a freshman. Like he was looking at me like, this cat just got here. And he said, I've been here a year and a half or so, and I can't bench 275. So he said we were a very focused group and hyper competitive. All of us were just dice, cards, whatever you want, drinks, whatever you want. We're competitive. and we took that on the court.
So once you get to 89, what's the feeling around that team? Like, what was like your goal, and when did you feel like you could get to them?
89, we wanted to win a national title. We kind of talked about that at the beginning, because the year before, we were in the second round against Villanova and had them beat. We were up 10 with about a minute, 50 seconds left. We couldn't hit our free throws, end up losing. We would have played Kentucky in the Sweet 16. We matched up very well with that particular Kentucky team. So we could have easily been Elite Eight our sophomore year. We were that good, and we were getting better down the stretch in sophomore year. We had some games on the road in the Big Ten where we were very impressive. So we kind of knew, and then that summer, the way we stayed on campus, all of us stayed on campus, and we ran, we lifted, we hooped, we partied, we did everything that summer together. And so we had intentions on winning the national championship.
Who was the best player that you guarded?
Obviously Jordan at the pro level, Clyde Drexler. Chris Morris, Auburn. 6'8", do it all forward. Hit me for 32, I believe, when I was a freshman at Illinois. Put me in a post, put me on a poster at the rim, shot about 3 jumpers in my mug from the parking lot, hitting up McCotton, and won me. He put on a clinic. I couldn't do nothing with him.
Can you walk me back to the Elite Eight game when you guys win? What that felt like?
It was pretty incredible for me, because I had a mixture of emotions, because I had a bad game. Sherman Douglas wore me out. I fouled out, and Lou Henson hits me on the bench. You know, I'm walking to the bench, and it's late in the game, 2 minutes, something like that. And he's, you know, he asked me, was I trying to throw the game? And it Lawrence, if my parents weren't in the stands that day, I might have hit him. I'm serious. And Coach Collins, bless his heart, saw it and jumped on me like, boy, you better sit down, you know, because he knew I was about to retaliate. And so I was really upset when he said that. But Larry Smith came in, we held the lead, we go to Elite Eight. You know, we're all good and party and everything. So it was kind of a trip. I was really angry. But then knowing that you're going to the Final Four, man, it washed all that away.
What do you take most away from the Final Four experience?
That in life, when you have a goal, you have to be very specific how you talk about it. Because we used to talk about getting to the Final Four, getting to the Final Four. We knew we wanted to win a national championship, but that wasn't central in our language that we spoke. We spoke Final Four. And so my lesson that I learned from that, that you got to be really specific and utilize the language like you've already done it. Like, we're national champs. We're going to Seattle to become national champions. That would have made a big difference. And I think that we were talking about the Final Four. We got to the Final Four, but we didn't close the deal. Great, one of the great basketball games in the history of the Final Four, Lawrence. 33 lead changes. 89-87 in a Final Four game. There's some incredible stats in that game. And we came up short. But I think I would have changed the language that I was using leading up to it, that I think may have made a difference.
How long did it take you to get over it?
I'm not all the way over it still. I play it off like I am. See, Lawrence, you get the good stuff out of me, man, because me and you are tight, right? And I feel relaxed, so I just go ahead and spew it on your stuff. So, you know, here it is. I'm going to give it to you straight. You know, it feels tough when you get into a situation where you're that close to winning a national championship and you feel like you did your part, right? You feel like, you know, whatever your role is, you did it. You try to do a little bit more. But you can't say that about everybody involved, right? And I'm not going to name names. I'll let people figure out what it is and who I'm talking about. But when you get older and you start to look at different programs and different patterns, you're like, wow. You know, on one end, it's like, man, it's amazing we got that far. But on the other end, it's like, man, but we had all this talent. We could have won 2 national championships. But it is what it is. So I'm still not quite over it, because the difference between an NCAA Final Four appearance, which is great because it really benefited my career, but a national champion, that opens up far more opportunities than it does a Final Four participant. It changes your life forever.
That being said, there's just the celebration last year, celebrating the 30th anniversary of you guys. How did that feel to have that?
Well, it felt great, you know, to see the guys, and we anticipated that we'd get great response, which we did. And, you know, it's just, you know, Lawrence, I see the business side of things differently as a 52-year-old than I did as an 18 and 21-year-old, being kind of intoxicated with orange and blue, if you know what I mean.
Absolutely.
And so you start to look at the landscape and you see a different situation. So, you know, there are some opportunities that I was privy to be included into, but I chose not to participate for various reasons. And then when we got there and I shared it with my teammates, why I wasn't doing what I was doing, and yet they did it anyway, they saw the response, and they had a sense of why I did what I did. Because we're still beloved, Lawrence. And if SB 206 was in effect when we were in school, if we would all be millionaires. Everybody off that team would be a millionaire. Easy. The money that we could make if the NCAA went to a profit-sharing system similar to the NBA, even if we made 46% and the universities made, what's the rest? I don't know.
54%.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, 54%. And you average out the amount per player on a 15-player roster. People in Illinois last year, not during the Flying Illini years, players last year would have made $400,000 apiece. Louisville's players would have made $1.5 million apiece had that type of profit sharing been in. So we know that that's not the case. We've had 30 years of people marketing the Flying Illini. Right? We're giving up interviews, doing all this, and everybody seems to benefit except us. And so, you know, when you see that type of thing, it's bittersweet. It's good to go back, but it's like, wow, you know, we probably could have somehow garnered a piece of this, if you know what I mean.
No, I got you. You have painted a very clear picture for me on in this regard. It makes a lot of sense, too. And it's funny because it's like you're kind of retroactively fighting for the things that the student athletes are fighting for now.
Exactly. Exactly.
Let's talk about the NBA for a second.
Okay.
What's your fondest NBA memory?
Wow. Nobody's ever asked me that. Fondest NBA memory. Wow, I got to think about that one. Probably one of the better times that I remember was Willie Anderson throwing me his keys to his Porsche so I could race off to the airport because I was with the San Antonio Spurs. I could race off to the airport because my son was being born. My wife at the time went to labor, so I had to, you know, drive 90 miles to the airport, jump on a plane, fly to Atlanta, and see my baby boy. So just the way that Larry Brown, he gave me a hug. He told me, hey, man, this is one of the biggest blessings that you'll ever have. Take the time that you need. We'll be here when you're ready. For a head coach, a Hall of Fame head coach, to tell you that, it meant a lot. So that kind of window right there, I'd say, kind of sticks out right now.
Considering that ESPN's getting ready to do this 10-part documentary on the Bulls' final championship, and you'd already brought up dealing with Jordan in the pros, what was it like to guard Jordan?
Helpless. I mean, if I'm being real, I mean, because, you know, Lawrence, I'm a defensive player. That's what I hold my hat on. But Jordan was, he was so focused and intense, and he's wired differently, that whatever you try to take away, whatever you try to load up on, you might get him once or twice, but he'll figure it out. He's so strong. He's so quick. He's so smart. And he's so competitive that, I mean, you just hope he had an off day. And it wasn't the, and the off day didn't really have anything to do with me or anybody else defending. He just was off because he's that good. And it's tough, Lawrence, because when, you know, you're sitting there guarding the guy and you're like, this could be the best player to ever play the game. And you can't be thinking like that because you sit there, you do that, and he's gone. You know, I remember being on a free throw line with Clyde Drexler, and I got in the game, and I'm sitting there looking at him like, dude, that's Clyde Drexler. And he looked at me, and he could tell, Lawrence, that I was doing a little stargazing. He's like, what's up, young fella? Like that, and then, you know, he turned back to the game. But it's surreal, man, but guarding Jordan, helpless.
Helpless is a good word. So you saying Clyde saw into your soul a little bit.
He did because he seen it happen a lot of cats. If they, the first time that you play these guys, you hope it's in a summer league, you hope it's in some informal situation so you can get that out of your system, because as men we try to be all macho and everything like that, but I'm gonna keep it real. I'm just like, yo, first time I saw Dr. J, I had to keep my hand from grabbing the pen and going up and asking for an autograph. I'm just kicking it real, bro. I had to fight the urge, man, because I'm a fan. I love Dr. J. And, you know, love Jordan, love Drexler. I watch these guys, man, wanted to be like them. And I'm just like a normal dude when it comes to that, Lawrence. I ain't faking the funk over here.
What are the best coaches that you've had in common?
They show they care about you outside of being a player. Their communication goes both ways. Mm. Not just one way, it goes both ways. They'll listen. And consensus builders, people who can bring different people together and get them on the same page and get people to accept their roles. I would say those three areas are really critical of, like, Larry Brown. Lou Henson had parts of that. Not all, but he had parts of that. Golly, I'm drawing a blank. Doc Rivers. People like that. Greg Popovich, because he was an assistant. He was great. At San Antonio when I was there. He was assistant. R.C. Buford was the GM. No, Pop was great even then. So guys like that, they have that ability to do those things.
I feel like you have a lot of that, Steven. I really do. Has the coaching route ever been something that you've even seriously considered?
No. No, I have, Lawrence. I'd be an excellent coach to some junior high students, or maybe high school students. I couldn't coach at the college or pro level because I'd hurt them cats, man. If you don't play hard, if you got some kind of ulterior motive and you're trying to be selfish, I can't deal with that. So I can work with young people because I've got some size over them. My voice is booming at times. I can kind of, you know, get at them a little bit and show, you know, in the next thing, turn around and hug them and tell them I love them, you know, and I can get to them. But college, pro, and Lawrence, the coaching lifestyle, it's a grind, bro. It's tough. It's tough. Tough on families. It's tough on relationships. And I really have a ton of respect for coaches that lay it on the line like that, but their families, they make sacrifices. And that was a sacrifice I just didn't want to make.
Okay, fair enough. I mean, that makes a lot of sense. Now I want to turn towards broadcasting. You know, okay. I talk to you about this all the time. I think you're the best analyst in America. When I watch you do games, I learn something. I take something from it. You tell me what's getting ready to happen in a lot of instances. And when something does happen, you're able to explain to me what just happened and why it happened before I get a replay. Like, the replay is waiting on you. You're not waiting on it. And I appreciate that as a viewer. When did you feel like, hey, I have something that I can bring to the game as a color analyst, and I want to get out there and prove it?
Well, first of all, Lawrence, thank you for saying what you said. That means a lot coming from you. And you know how I feel about your work and what kind of professional you are. So thank you for saying that. That means a lot. Repeat that, man. I was so enamored with what you said. That kind of threw me a little bit.
Well,
I appreciate that.
When did you think that you could add something to the game on the broadcast level?
You know what, Lawrence? It was really when I was in college and I got on a radio interview with Dick Vitale. And I did such a good job, the lines are still open. And Dick Vitale said, you know, Barter, you did good. What do you want to do when you get older? I said, Dick, I want your job. He and Lou Henson laughed because Lou was on the line. He's still online. I wasn't laughing. I was serious, Lawrence. And then the wisdom of Dr. Harold Bardo, my father, he told me write a letter to ESPN thanking them for the opportunity to come on the show, that you're a broadcast journalism major, and that you know, would like to possibly look at some opportunities upon graduation. Sent the letter out. Didn't think anything of it. About a month later, I get a letter back from the president of ABC Sports, Dennis Swanson, Illinois grad. Got the letter, heard about the letter, got the letter. Wrote me a letter, said, I'll be in Champaign for the USC-Illinois game in the fall. Would love to meet with you. Let's watch the game together. I'll take you to the truck, and we'll get to talk. Fast forward to the fall, meet with Dennis Swanson. Great meeting. He's a great dude. Learned about his background. Didn't realize how high up the chain he was, Lawrence. That's how naive I was, I guess. I didn't know. And I treated him, you know, like a nice guy and everything. And I think he appreciated that. And, you know, he ended up getting me in the business right after I finished playing ball. He got me in the business. And during the time that I was still playing, I would intern at CLTV with the infamous Rob Goldman. Remember Rob, right?
I do remember Rob.
Yeah.
So America remembers Rob.
Exactly. So I was on with Rob Goldman, and I was getting my reps, man. I was cutting my teeth on the Bulls playoff run, on their championship run. I was cutting my teeth in the offseason while I was still playing ball. And I got to the point where one night I took the filter off, and I was really poignant, Lawrence, and I stopped worrying about what people were saying. And I started being very strong with my opinion. And two or three people got back to me the next day. It was like, yo, I saw you, man. That was good stuff. And I knew then that if I could ever get comfortable enough to take the filter off and go, I would have something to offer. And then fast forward, while I'm working with ESPN, one of my first and second years, Terry Gannon is my brother from another mother. Love him to death. He treated me like a younger brother. I said, Terry, you know, I really want to be good in this game. I said, you know, how can I be great? He said, take the filter off. And so I've been working on that ever since, Lawrence.
Well, that's true.
I knew.
The filter's definitely off when you're on the air. Have you ever felt, have people pushed back on you? Because you're fair. I mean, it's not like you never say anything that's unfair. You're not personal. You don't attack people. But when it comes to the game not being played properly, you will for sure call that out. So what do you do when there's pushback against that?
I respect people's opinion. You know, I'm not for everybody. You know, I'm not everybody's cup of tea. And I understand. And it took a while to get comfortable with that, Lawrence. You know that. You know, that pushback that you get from coaches, I've heard from SIDs, I've heard from administrators before, and I've gotten so much better because I try to put myself in their shoes. And obviously they're getting blowback from somewhere, somebody, you know, maybe they understand it personally, but they're getting pressure from somewhere else. So, you know, these things are very intricate. And so I just, you know, I kind of shrug my shoulder and say, okay, you know, I'll hear them out if they want to call me or talk to me or shoot me an email or something or a text. Okay, that's fine. We're cool. It's not going to change the way I call a game. Mm. But, you know, I'll take it into consideration.
What do the best analysts that you like watching do when they're doing their job well?
Be succinct. Give the telecast air to breathe. You don't have to always fill it up with talking because we're in a visual medium. Now, radio is different. But be succinct with your analysis so that you always, your play-by-play partner always feels like if they need to get in and punch something home, they can. Like is usually the way that play-by-play works on radio. But play-by-play announcers are so used to laying back so much and waiting for the analyst that if the analyst has diarrhea of the mouth, it doesn't do well. I like partners, you know, that are laughing, inside jokes, talking. You know each other's tendencies. You know where to poke. You know, you have running things going through the season that are, you know, running themes that you can return to. You know, and you make it entertaining, Lawrence, because we're in the entertainment business. You know, I can sit there and analyze why this player did this the whole time or whatnot, but why not, you know, look at Zetus
Pantelis, yeah, from DePaul.
Why not look at Zetus Pantelis' hair or his
goggles,
you know, his goggles or his celebration, or the fact that he actually understands that this is a privilege, not a right. Why not look at that and point that out? Point out the positive things around the game so that people can, you know, because, you know, we have to be competitive. You know, this college basketball is not a, you know, it's not the number one. We're struggling to be top five. And so we have to really do our best as analysts because we're gateways to the sport. We have to be very succinct. We have to be very collaborative with our partners. We have to be collaborative with the programs so that we get good messages out. Not to be, you know, overly positive when you need to say something that needs to be said, but I think to enhance what's positive about the sport, to help the sport, I think that's our job.
Do you have a favorite game or moment that you shared on a broadcast?
Okay, be more specific there, Lawrence.
So, is there any game like inside of a moment like that you had inside of a game where you were like, man, me and my partner are clicking. This game is great. The atmosphere is unbelievable. Like everyone is in sync with what we're doing.
Oh, I have that a lot because I work with some of the best in the business, in my opinion. I think Kevin Kugler, Brandon Gowden, these guys are pros. They're pros. Who's the guy? Joe Davis.
Jeff?
Yes.
Jeff Levering, he's great.
Jeff Levering, yes. And so, you know, Corey Provis, all these guys that we work with are pros, and they're good dudes. I don't work with guys, Lawrence, that have egos. They don't have egos, and so they're very easy to work with. And we don't do it all the time. We can't get that flow all the time, but it happens more often than not. I think we had an incredible season because the level of play was so high. And so it was easy to kind of fill in around high level basketball to kind of, you know, add into that and let that be the story instead of, you know, trying to be a ball hog with the mic and trying to shine instead of, you know, just being supportive of the game that's being played.
Growing up in Carbondale, did you have an NBA team?
My brother liked the Bulls. I always liked the 76ers.
Oh, because of Dr. J.
Exactly. All right. I have a poster of Dr. J on my wall, bro. Man, listen, that was my man. But go ahead.
No, I just trying to, like, that's an area where I always try to figure out, like, if you get to, whether it's Carbondale or St. Louis, like, where are people, like, what team do they follow? And how do they follow that team, especially back in the 80s?
Yeah, that's a great question, because back in the late 60s, the St. Louis Hawks were there before they went to Atlanta. So a lot of, you know, that would draw a lot of regional attention, and people would, you know, find affiliation with them. But a lot of times, man, guys growing up there, I mean, football fans, you know, it's as varied in my house. Me and my sister are Steelers fans. My dad, you know, he loves the San Diego Chargers. My mom's a Cowboys fan. So,
wow.
Brother's a Chiefs fan. It's crazy, you know. So growing up there, you don't really have an allegiance to anybody, because you're just kind of in the middle of nowhere in terms of pro franchise.
Are there any other sports that you wish that you could sit down on a broadcast and be a part of?
Track and field.
I was not expecting you to say that. Why track and field?
Well, I competed in track and field. I was really good at it. I used to high jump, quarter mile, mile relay, 800. I love track. I still do. I can sit down and watch a track meet right now. So I would be Lewis Johnson, trying to speak a little bit of French or Spanish or something like that, trying to add some flavor to it. But I would love to call track and field, because I love the sport.
Oh, man, that's like not a man. That would be dope. Like, you doing like a Big Ten track and field tournament would be awesome.
No, I would eat that up, Lawrence. They would, the guys that would normally call it, they'd be in jeopardy of their job. I'm telling you. I put so much funk on it, man. They'd have to bring me back.
No, that 100%. That is the case. It's interesting, because one of the other things that I think about when I think about you as an analyst is you as a teacher, and that, you know, that goes all the way back to your family.
Mm-hmm.
The teaching aspect for the viewer, how important is that for you?
It's incredibly huge, Lawrence. I appreciate you recognizing that, because I think when you edutain, E-D-U-T-A-I-N.
The old KRS-One album, edutainment.
That's right. That's right. When you do those two things, people thirst for that. People love learning new things and helping them see the game a little bit better. It's like, oh, wow, I didn't really understand it. Now, when I see it, I know what I'm looking at. So now what's the next thing? You know what I mean? And then when you start to, you know, you start to educate viewers, you bring them back. They talk. And so you just have to, I look at it from I'm a grassroots guy, Lawrence. I think if I can affect one person in a positive way and I can get them to be fans or whatever, then I think that they will speak my value to 5 or 10 people. And if you can do that for one person and you can kind of focus your broadcast and your direction on trying to educate and entertain that one person, then it typically works out. That's the way I've seen it.
Okay. Now I want you to do some teaching for me. For these young cats that are out here that are trying to advance, whether they're junior high kids trying to advance to high school kids trying to advance to college kids trying to figure out how to make it to the NBA. You've done all of these things. What can you tell them about what they need to do to have the best opportunity to get to the next thing?
Great question. The earlier that you can devise a plan, the better. So I dropped a interview with Shea Cotton, who was a high school phenom. He's got a documentary coming out called Man Child. Shea shared with me that when he got on the Sports Illustrated cover at age of 15, they knew they had to really maximize his time. And he was in Long Beach and, you know, gang related activity going on around him, drugs and, you know, inner city, you know, typical inner city, lower socioeconomical situation. His parents created a time management chart that they would hang on the wall each week, and they would plot out his chunks of time. If you do that as a junior high student, and you do that throughout high school, that's a helpful tool. The second thing that I would tell anybody, whether it's high school going to college, college going to pro, keep somebody around you that's going to keep it real. Keep somebody that around you that's like, okay, I'm better than Kendall Gill. No, you're not. No, you're not. You're close, but you're not better than Kendall Gill, because Kendall Gill's working twice as hard as you are. And that's what happened in college. So you gotta have people around you to keep it real. And if you have people that can keep you grounded, and like you can look and see the competition and see what they're doing, you'll always learn. But if you don't have anybody around you, Lawrence, that can't keep it real with you, you stop learning, you become arrogant. But as long as you stay grounded and you start to look around at your competition, you start to look around at people you can emulate, you start to study people on the internet, YouTube, you can study any player you want. And so if you have that plan and you have someone around you to keep you grounded, I think those are two very critical things that can really help navigate you to where you want to go.
You were a defensive guy. A lot of these young cats, defense is not on their mind. How can they become better defensive players?
Well, defenders at the elite level, and I will call myself an elite level defender, it's a mindset. And you're kind of born with it. You can develop a little bit more tenacity, but you really just got to be a nasty, tenacious dude when it comes to being on the court. And I've always been that way. I told you earlier that my brother was 6 years older, and he used to treat me like a ballhead stepchild. I mean, like, no joke, bro. He used to wear me out, be physical, and so I learned that every time I went up against him, Lawrence, I had to muster everything in my body to compete with him. And I got used to doing that. And a lot of people they're not in that situation where they bring 100% to the playground, to the gym, whenever you compete, trying to muster everything you have in your body for that moment. That's a skill that some are born with, others have to develop. But that's what I would say. If you have those things and you study offensive players, study them, see where they struggle. See if they go left as opposed to them getting to their right hand. See if they like to, when they go left, they go into a jumper. When they go right, they go to the hole. You know, pick up patterns and then sit down with your coach and say, hey, coach, this is what I saw about this guy. I'd like to try to guard him. If you do that one time and you're successful guarding that person, you will get that assignment.
This was delightful, man. I appreciate your time. I know that your time is valuable, even in a quarantine situation. I know that your time is super valuable, but I thank you for this. This has been quite the learning experience for me, and that's kind of the whole point. Like, I'm able to give this, like, put it on the podcast. I share it with my students. I throw it on the air, and it ends up being great. Like, people love this type of stuff, like, to understand, because they watch you and they go, that's my guy. Like, Steven's my guy. And so them knowing more about you, I'm ecstatic that we were able to make this happen.
Oh, anytime, Lawrence. You know, you're one of my favorite people, man. And keep doing your thing. I love your content. Keep it coming.
I'll do my best, man. Thank you for this, and I will be in touch soon.
Okay, my man.
Appreciate All right, brother. You. Be well.
All right.
All right, man. See? That was a lot of fun, man. I learned a lot. I learned a lot about, like, what these coaches think. And it's great. I'm so happy that he was willing to engage in talking about his NBA career, because Steven didn't play for a long time in the NBA, but he played long enough. And hearing those stories about guarding Jordan and being awestruck with Clyde Drexler, like, those are great stories. Those are really, really great stories. So I'm glad that he was willing to share those stories. If you want to email the podcast, if you've got a guest idea for me, hit me up, houseoflpodcast@gmail.com. And as I was saying at the beginning of the episode, you can watch this episode on the YouTube page. Yeah, I have moved into the 20th century, 20 years into the 21st century. House of L Podcast YouTube page. right now, this interview is up along with the interview that I did with Joanne Martin about teaching and learning from home. I think you'll enjoy both of them. If the video thing is your deal, if you'd rather watch it via video, be my guest. I'm more than happy to keep providing the content for you. So that's going to do it for this episode. And let me tell you, over the last couple of weeks, I have scored some home run interviews. I'm really excited that people are okay with this and they're coming out in droves. So it's much appreciated. I thank you for the support of the podcast. It won't be 2 years officially until, what, June 1st, but we're over 400,000 downloads, which is way above the projections that I had for us in year two. So thank you, and tell someone that you think would like this about this. See you next time. Peace.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.